accession number 18499, Reel 2.
Aldridge Reel 2. You were just telling me about how easy navigation was in
Canada. Well, it was, especially at night time, because all the towns were lit up, and a lot of them had local radio stations with a big mast on with the code number of the radio station. I'm sure you couldn't go wrong, really, in a way. And it was a great shock when we came back here, sat navigating with no lights, of course. But that, apart from photography, bombing, and the navigation, that's what you really did at air navigation school. And about another 2 months' course, I suppose.
So what happened after Port Albert?
Well, after Port Albert, I remember we had a bit of leave on... Well, we were told to go back to... We had to go back to Moncton in New Brunswick to the transit camp, ready for getting another boat back here. And we had a certain amount of time over if we wanted to drop off anywhere before we... On our travel back. And I had an uncle and aunt in Toronto, and I know I spent a few days with them there. I went back to Moncton, and then you waited for another boat to come back from, and I came back from Halifax on the old Aquitania four funnel, and what a contrast, because by that time they were building up the American forces for D-Day, and the boat was absolutely crammed, decks and everything was packed with troops, and we flew RAF folk, and I came back to Liverpool. From there we went to another sort of depot, I suppose, I'd call it, at Harrogate, based in the Imperial Hotel at Harrogate, sort of holding centre. We were given about a fortnight's leave, and then we had to report back there. And here, it makes me wonder now the amount of time we spent wasted between, well, we call it wasted between courses, because from there, we went out to Whitley Bay, near Newcastle, on what was an aircrew commando course, they called it, where they dumped us in fields, and we had to fight for evasion, when eventually if we were over on the other side and bailed out and want to evade, you had to get back without using any transport or roads and that sort of thing, and a lot of physical training, and that's where I spent my 21st birthday, I remember. And we all said it was just time wasting, really. I mean, it amazes me now that at that time, which was December 43, Bomber Command was incurring its heaviest losses of the war. The Battle of Berlin was on at its peak, and yet we were wasting so much time. I don't know if my logbook tells you what. I came back from Canada, I think, in about October 43. And I don't think I flew again till about February 44, which was at AFU, flying unit.
Were you fretting to get into action?
Well, I mean, it just seemed a waste of time waddling around doing nothing, really, in a sense. And, I mean, we didn't realise then what, you know, it does, when you read of the losses they were getting then, and that training wasn't progressive. But anyway, I think I got to AFU about February 44, something like that, at Millham, up in Cumberland. On Hansen's. And there you did navigation, which came as a shock. Because night navigation was, I mean, you had been trained in Canada where all the places were lit up, and you came over here. And map reading at night, you found very, very difficult. And I can always remember going from Millham down to the Bristol area at night over Wales, and you just didn't, well, I ain't a clue. You couldn't map read up snow on the ground and that sort of thing. But you did your bombing training again there, and at daylight it was what we used to fly over the North Sea to the Isle of Man or across to Northern Ireland and that sort of thing. You could do map reading on your coastlines and that. No other advanced equipment we had. We had just basic stuff on the Hansens. And then that was more or less the end of basic training at AFU. From there you were posted off to operational training unit.
That was at Bruntingthorpe?
That was Bruntingthorpe near Lutterworth in Leicestershire, 29 OTU, and that's where you crewed up. That's a strange way they did it. You were all bunked in one hangar or one big room and more or less tried to pick yourselves into a crew. Oh, what a slap happy way it was doing it. It always amazed me. Anyway, we got crewed up without the flight engineer, of course, because we were on Wellingtons there. Didn't need a flight engineer. We did more and more cross-country work because we were introduced to G, navigation aid G, and the new Mark 14 bomb sight. And did hard training there, both day cross-countries, night cross-countries. Well, circuits and bumps at first, of course, on the old Wellington. And I don't know how long that was, but another couple of months, I suppose.
Can you tell me who was in your crew, what the composition of it was?
Yes, what, names?
Yes, and where they came from and the background.
Well, the skipper, captain, pilot was Ken Lee. He came from Yorkshire. His parents ran a carpet factory. Tom Gatfield was a navigator. He came from Islington Way in London, and he'd been in electrical work. The wireless operator, a chap called Dougie Pye, he was from Northern Ireland originally, and I think he had trained up to OTU stage, but they'd crashed and he was the only survivor of the crew, from what I remember. And two young gunners from Lancashire, only 19. Norman Powell, mid upper gunner from Warrington, and the little rear gunner, Vin Pascoe from Blackburn. What their jobs had been then, I don't know. And that was but the crew. And of course, I was the only. I used to think I was a bit of a Swede coming from Norfolk, old country boy. But we got on well together. Well, I suppose the only awkward one was Dougie Pye from Northern Ireland. He was, could have been a bit awkward, but we did well together, I think.
In what sense was he awkward?
Well, he didn't sort of blend in with the rest of us somehow or other. He was, you know, he could flare up easily. But, I mean, flying-wise, he was quite a good wireless operator. Well, and then we, of course, once we finished OTU, we had no incidents. We did very well, really. We didn't have any likely crashes or problems with the aircraft, although they were all clapped out all Wellingtons we flew. But and then we went on to 1661 Heavy Conversion Unit at Winthorpe, near Newark, on Stirlings. Because at the time, Harris had withdrawn, I think they'd withdrawn all Lancasters from heavy conversion units because they needed them in the main force until the production had built up more. We were converted onto Stirlings, although we were designated to go onto Lancasters, and we converted onto four engines on Stirlings. Picked up our flight engineer, who was Lou Crabb. He joined us there, and we did a similar course to what we did at on OTU, really. I mean, apart from the fact that it was more for the engineer and pilot. I mean, our equipment didn't change. Oh, apart from H2S. We started to train on H2S because the bombing was supposed to operate H2S system, the navigation system. And
how did you find H2S?
Oh, I got on well with it, very well. And I mean, it's not the answer to everything, but it did very well on it. And we.
How did you operate it?
Well, it was a screen with a orientated with north at the top, and a sweeping arm going round, and showed up for anything like a town showed up with a bright blip, whereas coastlines, sea was dark. Of course, you didn't get any response from the sea, and you got response back from the built-up areas. Oh, that could be very deceptive, because I can always remember Scunthorpe, which was a big steel area in those days. You could get far more response from Scunthorpe as a town than you could from a place like Derby, which was a big, much bigger place. But that just depended on, you know, the structures that were there. But lakes and coastlines were very good. And we used to try. You could do a bombing run on H2S by guiding the aircraft over. We used to do them on Nottingham, I remember. And we did cross country up to about 6 hours, I suppose, in the end at night. And then you were supposed to be really ready for the squadron. But of course, then as we were on Stirlings, we then had to be posted to what they call a Lancaster finishing school, which is at Syston. And there we converted on to Lancaster, more for the pilots. The rest of us, the equipment was the same. We didn't do many cross-country trips or anything like that, only short journeys, practice bombing. And the gunners were probably out to sea and fire at smoke markers or something like that. And the same, we had H2S and G.
What did you think of the Lancaster to fly?
Oh, I loved it. It was very good. Except for the main spar, you had to scramble over that every time to get up the front. Park your shins. But, I've got every thought for the Lancaster. She was really it, I thought. And served the purpose for what it was built with, bomb load and reliability. And then we were, from there we were posted to the squadron.
Which squadron did you go to?
49 Squadron at Fiskerton near Lincoln. And we got there just as their squadron in August 1944, they were converting to what was known in the code word as Village Inn, which was an automatic gun laying turret, which had a scanner on the rear turret, and the rear gunner had an automatic gun sight and a little infrared telescope. Well, you picked up the aircraft and it would show us a blip on his little screen, and at the same time you had pips on the intercom. Long distance pips were very slow, and as the aircraft closed in, the pips got quicker. In the wireless operations compartment was a range meter, which told you what the range this particular aircraft was. And the whole idea, well, of course, obviously, if you picked up a blip, it could be anything. It might be another Lancaster. But the theory was this, that this, at that time, they fitted all Bomber Command aircraft with Z equipment, which is infrared lights, two small ones on the front, perspex of the aircraft. And if the rear gunner looked through his infrared telescope, he'd pick up these infrared lights. And now it was one of our aircraft. Oh, I mean, if you get something closing it, you're very fast. You had a quick look. You wonder sometimes whether they'd study it very long. But that was the principle of it, that it was a radar scanner on the rear turret. There's only about three squadrons, I think, in the whole Bomber Command that had it. And we were converting then, just as we arrived at the squadron. And one unfortunate thing about this was, I don't know why, I suppose they thought that some of the rear gunners weren't up to using the equipment. So they took our little rear gunner, who we had trained with, away. And we had a pilot come as a rear gunner. One of these that I was telling you about that had got through his training, got his brevet, and they told him, you've got no hope of getting through to operational flying because there's so many pilots trained. But you've got the option of going onto a squadron and doing another sort of job. So I don't think they knew what it was. Anyway, they volunteered, some of them. We had about six come on our squadron, I suppose. And one of them was ours, Roy Wilkins. And he then joined us and trained on this equipment till they reckoned we were operational, which took nearly a month. And at the end of September 44, we started our operational flying.
I think your first operation, 26th of September, was on Karlsruhe.
Yes.
Can you remember that?
I can remember it very well.
What happened?
Because we got a contact as we were approaching the target on Village Inn, on the rear gunner. And he gave, it was closing in, and he gave the order to corkscrew, take evasive action. And we did. And we lost the aircraft. And by that time, it was too late for me to line up on the markers, on the target markers on the bomb site. So I had to say, dummy run and go round again, which wasn't very pleasing to the rest of the crew. You can imagine the remarks that were made. What a B-bomb aimer. But you couldn't help it. I sure remember the first one, anyway. But apart from that, that was nothing happened. We got no more contact.
And then I think the next one was on Kaiserslautern.
Yes, that was a
next day.
That was a small town, that one. I can always remember that. I think we were flying very low, 6,000 feet perhaps, something like that. And I can always remember seeing the whole of the middle of on those two operations, we were loaded with nothing but incendiaries, so obviously they were intending us to bomb the towns. But I remember Kaiserslautern had two aiming points. One was supposed to be for the rail yards, and the other one was a town. And I can remember seeing the whole of the middle of the town. I really didn't see one as close as that in flames, including the rat house, the town hall, and everything was blazing. I can remember. That is what I remember of Kaiserslautern.
What would you have to do as you went in, during the operation? Can you describe the various work that you did on a typical operation?
Well, up to the time, well, I was supposed to sit by the navigator and operate H2S, but of course, as I will say, that we weren't allowed to use H2S because Germans had introduced Naxos equipment on their night fighters, which homed onto H2S transmissions. And apart from Pathfinders, the main force element, were not allowed to use H2S, so very often there wasn't much to do till we got there. Then I used to go down to the bomb aimer's position, set up my equipment, we'd get a wind probably over the radio to tell us what the wind to set on the bomb site. I used to set that, and so we were all ready for the run in, and then we normally had to go in on a certain heading, especially if you were using incendiaries, because they used to like to spread them over the town. Everybody didn't go in the same heading. And then I'd guide the pilot to a release point, which was a lighted cross on a flat plate of glass. And once this centre of this cross lined up with the markers, normally they were red markers, you released your bombs. And you're supposed to stay straight and level till the photo was taken. Of course, you had a camera on board, but the photo flash dropped, and you're supposed to take a photo of the aiming point at the time the bomb shot. And that was really all there was in it, as far as the bomb aim was concerned then. One other job was because we dropped wind over the old metal strips to upset their radar stuff, and you had a certain mark on your map where they told you to drop wind, and that was in the bomb aimer's compartment down a chute. And that was another job. If I was occupied back in the navigator's department with using navigation equipment, the flight engineer used to put the window air in little packets, and you just shoved it down this chute and it went out. But that was that. Apart from that, there was nothing, much to do.
Your third operation on the 18th of October was to Nuremberg.
That's right. We'd moved then to Fulbeck, which is near Newark from Fiskerton. And we were actually the first aircraft in the squadron to operate from Fulwick. We were the first to take off. I can't remember much about Nuremberg. It was cloud covered, I'm sure, I know, because we had to aim at the, you could see the target indicators through the cloud, and you just aimed at these. I think it was practically the first time that they'd bombed Nuremberg since the dreadful time they'd had in March 44, when they lost almost 100 aircraft, didn't they? But it was nothing unusual in the trip, as far as I can remember.
Were the facilities at RAF Fulbeck any different from Fiskerton?
Well, it was. We moved in after the Americans had been there with the paratroop squadrons, and they'd flown out to Arnhem from there, and when they came back and moved down south, ready for the D-Day, I suppose, really. And D-Day was over, but they moved down south then, and RAF took over this base, and it was in October time. There was mud everywhere. It was dreadful when we first got there. It was, conditions underfoot. And the huts, I can always remember, the Nissen hut we were billeted in there was a circle of bullet holes in the side of the Nissen hut where somebody had sprayed it, an American paratrooper sprayed it with a handgun or something or other, I think. But it was very basic, the real basic old wartime built aerodrome, that one.
And your next operation, the 28th of October, was to Bergen.
Yes, that was a very eventful one. We went to bomb Bergen, and we got there. And of course, on occupied countries, they've had very strict rules. If the pathfinders couldn't really mark the target, you weren't allowed to bomb. Well, we got to the lovely and clear all the way there, and of course, Norwegian coast is a bit tricky. You get to the Norwegian coast and you find fog. They couldn't mark the target accurately. They told us to orbit over the sea, which we did for a little while, and finally the master bomber called it off and said, abort, and we had to go back. We came back, and of course, with all the bombs on, we had the oil up weight was too big, too much for landing, so we had to go to Jetson area in the North Sea, which is off Yorkshire from what I remember, and get rid of some of the bombs to bring your oil up weight down, which we did. I remember it was a terrible night there. It was pouring a rain, and we had this static, the props were all blue circles from the static electricity, and I moved my finger across the perspex in the bomb aerial compartment, and this blue light followed your finger across. Unusual it was. And of course, as soon as we'd done that, we got diversion orders to Marston Moor in Yorkshire. That's where the conditions, I suppose, in the home base closed right down. And we got to Marston Moor, and I kept down in the bomb aerial compartment. I went, because I was responsible for the front guns, the front turret, and I was unloading the guns once we got in the circuit. And I sat on the step in the bomb aerial, which wasn't really, is frowned on if you're sat right in the front, you shouldn't do it. I sat there. I think I was getting my camera magazine off, which was in that apartment, and sat on the step when we approached the runway, and I thought, well, Kenboy, you've got to land way up this runway some reason or other. And of course, he landed too far up the runway. And I, with the bomb, what we had, we were full weight for landing, and we carried on right off the end of the runway and crashed across the main road, hit the ditch, took all the undercarriage off, and we came to a grinding halt because we knew we'd got bombs underneath us. And I can always remember there's dead silence for a second, and somebody said, let's get out of this bloody aircraft, and we all scrambled out off the top, out and down the side, and went into a ditch and hid, because we could sort of see, looked like smoke coming up from the aircraft. We thought she might go up, catch fire. But it must have been the glycol, I think, that was burst. And we got in the ditch, we couldn't find the rear gunner. Suddenly he came staggering along. When we hit the ground, his turret had swung, and he was undoing his gun, what they call a cocking toggle, pull the breech block back to unload your guns. And there he was staggering up the road, joining us in the ditch with this thing in his hand. His turret had swung and he'd fallen out. But that was quite an event. And up came the blood wagon and the fire engine, and we said, there's bombs on board. And of course, they disappeared back for a bit. Finally, they saw nothing was happening, so they came, and we went back to the sick quarters then, and they gave us some pills and that, and we spent the night there. They were shaken up. Nobody was really physically hurt, but it was quite a do on our third operation, our fourth operation. And went back the next morning for our thing. She's laid there with her back broken. The queer thing about it is it was the actual the wing commander's aircraft we'd been using on our operations when he wasn't flying. He didn't, squadron commander didn't fly as frequently as we did. And, of course, we never did use his aircraft again.